views and opinions expressed by callers, guests, and hosts do not necessarily reflect those of the Black Talk Radio Network and Black Talk Media Project. Black Talk Radio is new black media for the new millennium. Good afternoon. You are tuned in to Black Talk Radio News. My name is Scotty Reed. I'm broadcasting from behind the enemy lines that I call USA Inc. Today is a Tuesday. It is November the 22nd, 2016, as we kick off some of our live broadcasting for you today on our digital radio station, Black Talk Radio Network, providing you with new black media for the new millennium. We'll be on air for about the next hour and 45 minutes, and then later on continuing the live streaming for tonight will be Tando Radio Show, and then at 9 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time will be the Code Breakers. So we have about 6 hours of live programming for you today on the station, so make sure you keep it locked here. I hope y'all listening all the time, but we definitely want you tuned in when we're streaming live. Well, we do have a guest plan for you today, and unfortunately this is one of those stories that just really underscores when I say behind enemy lines. I just don't say that as a tagline. I do not just say that to try to be a shock jock or anything like that. When I study the 13th Amendment and see the impact of the 13th Amendment arising in prison slavery, everything that is associated with prison slavery, when I look at the United States having the world's largest population of prisoners often being exploited for their labor, whether it's by corporations or by states, and then we have to mention, and this is just not specific to black folks, although that is our primary focus on this station, but it affects all quote-unquote Americans, especially when we're talking about police violence and brutality. I have not checked the latest killbypolice.net statistics, but I'm sure we're over 1,000 heading into the month of December. Now, as Killed by Police say, this is not to say that all of these killings were unjustified or extrajudicial murders. They're just keeping a tabulation of just how many people are being killed by police. But too many of those are just needless death. So all of this system, it is why I say that, and why we don't have people who are being massacred in huge numbers, like 100, 200, 300, when we look at places like Tulsa, Oklahoma, and many other places where non-white people, indigenous people, black people were attacked. In this book that Mr. DeSantis, John DeSantis, who is my guest today, it's just one of those sad, sad stories in this long history of sad stories on this continent, unfortunately. We hope for change. The only way that change is going to come about, in my opinion, is by changing the programming, that people are getting. So Mr. DeSantis, in this book that we'll be discussing today, The Thibodeau Massacre, Racial Violence, and the 1887 Sugarcane Labor Strike. This is a true crime book, and I'm glad it's described as crime, because this is what it is. And this book was published and went on sale this month. Just so you know, if you want to get autographed copies, you can only get those by going to John's website, which is johndesantis.org. If you are listening to the program from Black Talk Radio Network and this program page specifically, that has been linked up for you. But again, that is johndesantis.org. Let me spell DeSantis for you. DeSantis. So that's johndesantis.org. You can purchase the books at other places like Amazon as well. But if you want an autographed copy, go to johndesantis.org. So coming up after our interview with him, I want to go over some of the news of the day. I have some news specifically out of Gaston County, North Carolina, the home base of Black Talk Media Project and the Black Talk Radio Network. And it's pertaining, although it was a local press conference that was held where you had U.S. Senator Tom Tillis speaking. You also had Representative McHenry was present, and you had the police. I assume there was the police chief of Gastonia Police. It could have been the Gaston County Police Chief. But how they are implementing this drug diversion program, and I think that people need to hear this press conference because it has national implications, according to Senator Tom Tillis. Some of that quote unquote reform in the criminal justice system that might be coming down the pipe. So I definitely want to share that with the listeners. Okay, so without further delay, I want to also let the listeners know, again, we are on a new conferencing system. Many of the hosts still trying to get used to it, but after about the 30-minute mark, we hit halfway, I will announce, but you will be able to call in. Please don't wait till the last minute. We only have Mr. DeSantis for an hour, so please don't wait till the last minute. If you have any questions or comments that you would like to share, let me give out those telephone numbers. That the toll-free U.S. and Canada number is 866-510-9025. That's 866-510-9025. You can also join us via your computer by going to uberconference.com/Black Talk Radio Network. That's uberconference.com/Black Talk Radio Network. Where we're broadcasting, we have provided a link because we do also have a chat room in there, but you can also find more toll-free numbers for the different countries that our listeners may be located in. And again, you can call in through your computer. So without further delay, I want to bring on Mr. DeSantis. Mr. DeSantis, thank you for joining us, sir.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Yes, sir. Now, I want to give you an opportunity in a condensed version just to give people a little bit of background about yourself. I see that you have a strong journalist background, and I think that's really important to point out in terms of you writing this book, which you call A True Crime Book. But could you give people, Mr. DeSantis, a little condensed version of your bio just so they'll get to know the author?
Certainly. I'll be telling my age a little bit by doing it, but I don't mind that. I had in the early 1980s been working on the streets of New York, doing coverage of various things for the Associated Press and United Press International. It was a time that was a very violent time in New York. Had done some other things like that, then covered Brooklyn courts. While I was covering Brooklyn courts in 1989, there was a very tragic incident that occurred in the community of Bensonhurst. A young man named Yusuf Hawkins was shot in cold blood simply for the color of his skin. And that was met with a huge movement of people. There were many marches. I covered all of that. And that was my first book. It was called For the Color of His Skin, The Murder of Yusuf Hawkins and the Trial of Bensonhurst. I continued working for other newspapers, many of them in the New York Times chain of newspapers. And in 1994, after seeing a lot of the furor that had occurred involving the Rodney King case in California, Rodney King had lived in justice issues for a New York Times-owned paper. And during that time was when I began to hear that in the little town of Thibodaux, Louisiana, 129 years ago tomorrow, that something very terrible had happened.
And that leads us to your book. Now, you had actually, did you move down there because you just wanted to personally live in Louisiana, or were you pursuing career opportunities? Because in your book, you mentioned the different papers you were working for.
Well, originally, I had come to take time off. I had the first book had been published. I had come to Louisiana, and I really didn't know that I wanted to do journalism anymore. I was going to live in a garret in the French Quarter and write short stories that nobody was going to read until after I died. But along came a hurricane called Andrew, which I ended up covering on a freelance basis for the Washington Post. I met very amazing people in South Louisiana. I also realized as I lived here that there were many changes that need to be made everywhere, but that there were certainly things that needed to be looked at more closely here. And that was when I decided to get a job with the Houma Courier, where I had worked for a number of years.
Now, you it wasn't Andrew in your book that you mentioned. I think it was, did you mention Katrina? And no, it wasn't Katrina. I'm sorry, sir. You write in the preface of your book about the 2015 murders of the victims of Dylann Roof, whose trial is going on right now, supposed to be. I can't recall right now what stage it's in. But you mentioned in your book that the murder of the 9 innocent people at Mother Emanuel AME in Charleston, South Carolina, and the resulting dialogue resounded even in the extreme South Louisiana. So can you talk about that a little bit?
Absolutely. Scotty, what happened was that I had been researching the Thibodaux massacre, trying to find out what happened for many years, but I had not collected enough information on my own beyond the scholarship that was available from different sources, things people had published, to feel comfortable writing a story in the newspaper about it. Now, Houma, where I was working, was right next door to the little town of Thibodaux, and I had hoped, it had been my hope, that a local newspaper in this place where this atrocity happened would finally tell the story, because that had never happened. Well, when the killings occurred at Mother Emanuel, my feeling was I can wait to try to perfect what I want to do no longer. If America maybe is going to have some serious racial dialogue because of this tragedy, then the time for Louisiana to face its own things that have occurred needs to happen now. So I wrote a story that ran in the paper I work for now, the Times of Houma and Thibodaux. I put as much information as I had into it on the massacre. And I had heard a couple of months later from a publishing house, the History Press, and they said, "We've read your story on this. We're interested in publishing a book. Is that something you would be interested in doing?" I told them, I don't know, because I don't know if I can give you something all that new. I mean, there's been very little information on this incident that was out there. But I agreed to do it, and I have to tell you, and I have to tell your listeners, from that point on, it was as if some kind of a spiritual key had turned inside of a lock, and suddenly there were things involving this incident that, rather than me going after them, came to me. And that's how most of my last year was spent, in dealing with the uncovering themselves, I believe, because it was time for them to be uncovered.
That's kind of powerful. So you didn't really plan to write the book, or the spirit of the moment motivated you to write the book, and then all of these disinformation began to present itself in various ways. Is that correct?
Yes, I was going to do a book because I made a commitment to doing it.
Okay.
I didn't know, and I wasn't sure how much more beyond some reference sources that we know are out there.
Gotcha.
And maybe some reaction from people in today's times to it. I didn't know how much further than that I would get. And that's what I told the publisher. But they said, no, we have faith in you. Go ahead and do what you do. And that is when some fascinating things happened. And one of those, if I can jump to what one of those was.
Yes, I was going to ask you for an example. Yes, please.
With the help of an archivist at Nicholls State University, I was able to find something, or actually he found something, that I had not been able to find for almost 10 years. And that was a document that had the names of eight of the people who were killed in the Thibodeau massacre. And up until this book was published, every account of this, which is mostly from newspapers of the time, mm-hmm. referred to these people who died as just some Negroes. That was how they were called. And now, and we don't have all the names, but we were able to find eight names. And with the eight names, that was when we were able to find the centerpiece of what this book is, which is we had, for the very first time ever, accounts of what occurred in Thibodeau between 30 and 60 black people killed by white vigilantes. We had first-person accounts of that in documents that those names ended up leading us to.
Wow. What about names of the perpetrators?
Some, yes. Some names were in there. We do know that, and it had been known, that certain people who were in great positions of power at that time were the people who fomented this violence, were the people who led this violence, and one of them was the lieutenant governor of Louisiana at the time, Clay Knobloch. Another was a judge. It's interesting, Scotty, you mentioned extrajudicial actions. Well, in this case, it was a judge who was the leader of the community, the white community, who ended up being the person who took certain steps that made violence almost inevitable.
Mm. Wow.
And his name was Taylor Beatty. There were other people too. One person that hopefully we'll get a chance to talk about today, who figures very prominently in this book, Jack Conrad, named three people that he recalled as the people who shot him. Mm-hmm. And that is the first time those names have ever been made public.
Well, let's jump into the book, because, I mean, very interesting conversation with you thus far. But let's focus on the central event that the book is based on. Now, for the listeners out there, if you just Google the Thibodeau Massacre, this is what it's going to say. Because I like doing these type of exercises when I read books, and then I'll go somewhere like Wikipedia, which gets millions of visitors, and I just check to see, if they are, you know, relaying accurate information, or if they're watering it down, or if the, but this is just an excerpt of what Wikipedia says. It says the Thibodeau massacre was a racial attack mounted by white paramilitaries in Louisiana in November 1887. It followed a three-week strike by an estimated 10,000 workers against sugarcane plantations in four parishes in during the critical harvest season. So when they did you uncover that there was like paramilitary involvement, or is that another word for law enforcement?
No, that had been discussed before by some scholars who, you know, waded into this over the years. It was known that there were various of people in official or semi-official capacities who were involved in the violence. I will say, and there were varying degrees of that. The Louisiana State Militia, in about a week and a half prior to everything erupting into the massacre, they had been systematically evicting thousands of sugarcane workers from the plantations that they lived and worked on. That was the first wave. They brought a Gatling gun with them from New Orleans to this little town and had it stationed up on the courthouse steps where the judge I mentioned had his headquarters. There was also a local militia, and this was referred to as the Lafourche Parish Militia, but in addition to that, several days before the shooting occurred, there was a mass meeting that was roughly about 300 white people, and this was done in the town hall. And at that point in time, that is when the vigilante actions began really taking shape. It was roughly November 20th, and so you had the paramilitaries, you had the military had been involved, and you also had citizens who were not affiliated with anything military at all. I should mention that one of the things that became very clear in the research, this did not start out as a movement by black people to assert themselves as black people. This started out as a labor issue. This was a strike, as you mentioned. It was the white population of Thibodeau, at many of whom still had not gotten used to the fact, 22 years after the Civil War had ended, that these black people who worked on these plantations were no longer anybody's property. And these people who were working on these plantations, I might add, had come back to a situation where things were not much different from when they had been slaves. They did not get paid regular wages. They got paid in plantation scrip, you know, owing your soul to the company store. That was quite a literal thing. And leaders in the black community at that time, and Scotty, I have to tell you this, there is an amazing, despite the tragedy that occurred, there is an amazing story of empowerment of people here. Because at that time, only, you know, just less than a quarter of a century after the war, these people were able to organize themselves to a point where in several Louisiana parishes, the word spread and they stuck to it and they did not work. And this infuriated a lot of the planters, and it certainly infuriated the governor and the lieutenant governor.
Hence the violence.
Yes, the violence, it, and this is, of course, more thoroughly detailed in the book, and I write better than I speak, I guess. That's why they pay me to write. But essentially, well, and I can give you in a nutshell what happened on that morning right before dawn. The judge I mentioned had sealed off the town, and people could not leave, people could not enter.
Wow.
There were, at that point in Thibodaux, there were thousands of black people who had come from these plantations that they had been evicted from. It was kind of like Thibodaux became a refugee center. Thibodaux also had a thriving black community, which gave some of these people shelter. The people who were striking, they put up their wives
when
and
you
their
say,
children.
I'm sorry, Mr. DeSantis.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. When you say it had a thriving black community, are you talking about free black people?
Oh, yeah. Well, these were all free people. I mean, this, like I said, this is 20-some-odd years after the Civil War ended.
Okay.
And primarily now, in addition to the field workers, and field workers cultivating and harvesting sugarcane was the that was the crop. That was what was done there. That's what most black people at that time in that region did. But there were also some artisans. There were some business owners that were black. And some of them, including business owners, including black masons, who were very respected within the community, teachers, black teachers who taught in plantation schools. They were among the people who had spread the word for the people to strike, and they actually presented written demands to the planters. And when they would not give in, when they wouldn't stop striking, when all these people were gathered in Thibodaux, on the morning of November 23rd, two of the white pickets, the guards who were keeping people from going in and out of the town, were fired upon. Nobody knows by who. And they were wounded. They were not killed. That is when the call to arms went out. And it was a call to arms, I think we present adequate evidence of this, that people were waiting for. And people got on their horses, they rode into that black section of Thibodaux, and they began shooting people. They began pulling people out of their houses. We know this because we have, again, for the first time ever, the actual statements from people that this happened to or who witnessed it happen, and we have evidence from those documents, which are in the U.S. National Archives, sat there for more than 100 years, that the shooting went on for 2.5 hours.
I know, as I was going over your book, I was reading such accounts, like how they would take somebody to the railroad tracks and then tell them to run for their lives and then just shoot them down. So, I mean, very horrific accounts in here. Let me ask this question. Now, I know this is, as you keep mentioning, shortly after the Civil War. Now, I do know after the Civil War, black codes, what people refer to Jim Crow, they're referring to the black codes, the laws that were passed to further subjugate black folks to white supremacy. At that time, I'm not sure, were the Second Amendment rights being denied to black people at that time? Because I'm trying to think, I mean, were there any accounts of anyone trying to defend themselves? Because that's one thing I have learned, Mr. DeSantis, in reading of these accounts from the past, where you have a high number of casualties of black victims, is that most time I never hear of anyone being in possession of firearms as a community to defend themselves. So did anyone try to defend themselves, or was it illegal for black people to have firearms?
Scotty, that's a very perceptive question. And it's I'll try to give a non-complicated answer, although it gets a little complex. One of the things that the book does is it gets into the period after the war when actually, and we're talking 1866, 1867, into the 1870s, Louisiana was under Republican rule, under Reconstruction, in this community and others, but this one in particular, there was actually, we're talking years before the massacre, there was a black militia. It was led by a former soldier named Benjamin Lewis. And these people were permitted to have arms. They were chartered by the state. They were part of this, what amounts to the state National Guard. In Thibodaux, we have evidence, and it's in the book, that those people, back in the 1870s, kept some of the atrocities that were happening in other parts of Louisiana during that very tumultuous time from happening in Thibodaux. When Francis Nichols became governor in 1886, his first, excuse me, in 1876, his first go-round, the first thing that he did, it was the reestablishment of democratic rule, and these were all ex-Confederates like Nichols himself. They took the guns away from Benjamin's militia by order. We have a copy of the order. And black people, from that point on, in these sugar parishes, never organized in the same way again. Now, during the tensions that led up to the mass murder, there were rumors that black people were stockpiling guns, and there were raids on some homes. We document this in the book as well. However, those raids turned up nothing. There were some people in possession of guns. They were mainly the guns they would use for hunting. They were not being used much for self-defense. There were scattered instances during the strike of someone firing on sugar houses where scabs were working. But in no way was there any type of an armed insurrection. And I should also note, and this is what we found in going through all the records that we could check once the doors opened for us, we found that the only instances of November 23rd, 1887, of white people being injured was from the two that I mentioned earlier that just before dawn had been shot and wounded. And again, I caution, we don't know by whom.
Yeah, but, well, I don't have any sympathy for them because, as you stated, they were helping to keep these people pinned in for the pending massacre to come. So, yeah, but, it's important that you document, though, you know, what actually occurred. But, like you said, they were not killed, and nobody knows who shot them because it could have been what some people today would refer to as a false flag. We don't know. People do things.
We don't, and there is speculation toward that end, and we were not able to find any viable proof that anyone associated with the strike had done this. Indeed, some black community leaders in the years that followed this made very strong suggestions that a false flag was indeed what had occurred. Certainly, the white people in Thibodaux very quickly armed themselves just before dawn and went about what they went about doing.
All right. Well, I am up against a station identification break. Do want to let the listeners know when we come back on the other side of this break, if you have any questions or comments for our guest today, Mr. John DeSantis, we're discussing the massacre that occurred in Thibodaux, Louisiana in 1887. The title of his true crime book is The Thibodaux Massacre, Racial Violence in the 1887 Sugarcane Labor Strike. Again, if you would like to purchase this book and want an autographed copy, you can go to johndesantis.org. Our telephone number is 866-510-9025. That's 866-510-9025 or 704-802-5056. 704-802-5056. We'll be right back after this short break. You're listening to Black Talk Radio News. Down. Talk Radio since 2008, providing new black media for the masses. And welcome back to Black Talk Radio News. If you are on the board and you have a question or comment, just hit **. That will unmute you. Watch your background noise, and then I will call on those who have unmuted themselves if they have a question or comment. Before I interrupted you earlier to ask you a question, Mr. DeSantis, you were saying that there was a particular story that you wanted to share, if you want to go back to that.
Yes, and thank you so much for that. I need to speak a name, a man whose name was Jack Conrad. And Jack Conrad becomes very important in the telling of this story. And I know you have listeners who have questions, so I'll try to make this brief. But among the names that we were able to find, and once I had the names, I started trying to do some back searches, genealogy searches, and as I'm sure you and many listeners know, that's very difficult in the United States to do with black families because of slavery. And because of how they kept records, they didn't let the people have last names in the census records. And I was able to go back as far as the 1870 census with these people. One of the individuals was a young man. He was 19 years old. His name was Grant Conrad. And there was not much to say about him. Of course, his life mattered, but Grant Conrad was a sugarcane worker, and he was one of the names I had. And when I checked his background, I saw that his father was this man named Jack Conrad. Here is why this is important. Jack Conrad had a documented history. It turned out that Jack Conrad, who was born a slave in Lafourche Parish, Louisiana, near Thibodaux, Jack Conrad left the plantation in 1862 during the Union Army occupation. He joined Lincoln's Army. He joined the United States Colored Infantry. And he stayed fighting in the war through the entirety of the war, from the time he mustered in 1862. And he came back to the plantation after the war. There was nowhere else for him to go. He moved his family to Thibodaux. He lucked out, or, you know, worked very hard and had learned skills additionally to what he used to do. And he had become a mechanic, which was very important on the sugar plantations. He got to live off the plantation. He lived in a little house in town that he rented. And he is important because back years after this happened, 3 years after the massacre to be precise, U.S. Congress passed a law that said that if you were a Union Army soldier, if you fought in the Civil War for the Union, and if you had suffered injuries after the war that kept you from working, then you could file a claim for what they called an invalid pension. Jack Conrad, in 1890, filed for an invalid pension. The reason he was not able to work was the documented 4 gunshot wounds that he had received during the massacre. A person who was researching this for me in Washington, D.C., located his pension file. Scotty, this pension file was 200 pages long. And in that file was Jack's account of what happened to him, wow, of witnessing his 19-year-old son being shot down, of witnessing other people being shot down. And there were accounts of other witnesses, and these were all sworn to and subjected to scrutiny by War Department examiners. And so there, in those files, untouched for a century, was the true story of what happened during the Thibodaux massacre.
Wow, that's really powerful. for a victim's testimony to you know, just come out all these years later and to survive and for you to find it. Wow, that's
it isn't, well, as I told you in the beginning, it was like a spiritual key turned a lock. May I share something more with you in regard to that, Scotty?
Yes, yes.
Well, there was another miracle that happened in terms of putting this together. Unfortunately, it occurred after the book was completed and was in the stage of being, you know, prepared for publication. However, I could not get Jack Conrad out of my head. And I was determined if I could find relatives, living relatives of Jack Conrad, I wanted to. And I kept looking. And finally, I did it the right way. And I was pretty sure that I had people who were descendants of this man. I found them. I spoke with them. They now know who Jack Conrad is. They didn't know who he was before. But we tested the lineage in terms of obituaries and what's available in the census. And there is absolutely no mistake. There is no room for mistake here. And we had a launch for the book at Nicholls State University in Thibodaux Sunday before last. Relatives of Jack Conrad came wearing ribbons bearing his name. On Friday, the day after Thanksgiving, they are gathering from different states in Thibodaux at the site where we believe, but we don't know yet, where a mass grave is said to exist. And they are going to have, and this was, I mean, I didn't organize this. This was the family choosing to do this. They're going to have a New Orleans jazz funeral for Grant Conrad, a faux funeral. He may be there, but we don't have access yet, but we're working on that with the university. They are going to have a funeral procession for him. In the manner that their family does as part of their custom on Friday. And they are going to say prayers of release for Grant Conrad at that time.
Well, thank you for sharing that. That is really powerful. I tell you, I have actually over the years have stressed the importance of one knowing their own family history. Now, not that I'm saying that there's anything to be ashamed about, because if your ancestor was a victim of slavery, what is that to be ashamed about? They didn't do anything wrong. They were the victims of a crime against humanity. But I also have found doing my own personal family tree research that I cannot say that I'm a descendant of an African who was enslaved. I cannot say that. And it's a lot of people don't know that a lot of the 1860, or it was either the 1860 or 1860 census, there was listed in the census, this is during pre what I call pre 1865 slavery, and you had a free population of black people described to be about 500,000, so that's a 500,000. And so I think that, you know, it's just shameful that particularly black people, we really don't know our lineage and we don't know our personal family histories. And we automatically assume, again, no shame in being the descendant of a victim of slavery. But wouldn't you want to know for sure? And I mean, so just I can imagine how those people felt when you came to them with that information, being it was under a tragic circumstance, but just to find out about an ancestor.
They were just incredibly moved. They were incredibly, in fact, I have to do a book signing tonight in New Orleans, and some of them are coming there. The most amazing thing was talking with a man on the telephone that I was able to find, who was a direct descendant of Jack. Not his, like, great-great, you know, great-grandson or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Jack Conrad's great-grandson. And he was just the most incredibly dignified man. his name is Sylvester Jackson. I had the honor of meeting him. And now that he knows about Jack and his family history, I mean, his family had done what they could to find the history. And their history stopped with the generation right after Jack, unfortunately. But we were able to make the connection. And in terms of pride, Jack Conrad, as I mentioned, was a soldier. He joined Lincoln's army.
Right.
Jack Conrad's son, he had a daughter, and they had a child who was in the military. And then they had a child who is the gentleman that I got to meet, who was a career man in the Air Force. And he has a son who is very much around and with us today, and a very vital, wonderful individual named Baron Jackson. And he has had a military career. Mm-hmm. So this family has now learned that their service to this country dates back at least to the Civil War, and they're very pleased to know that.
Wow, that's a great story. That's a great story within this story. I do have some questions. We do have people on the board, but no one has signified that they have a question. Sometimes my listening audience is like that. They rather learn than talk sometimes. So, you know, don't feel like they're uninterested, but because they are. But I do have some other questions. Now, you mentioned that incredible story about finding a complete account by Mr. Conrad in the, what did you say, the Veterans Pension Board or something, where you found
it? It was in a file in the United States National Archives. And I should add, by the way, and for people who are looking at their genealogy, there is a wonderful collection of records from these many, many men who served the Union Army who were black.
Okay.
And members of the various United States colored forces, I'm sure many of your listeners have seen the movie Glory.
Yes.
Those people, the 54th Massachusetts, various units that fought in the war, they have very, very complete files on some of them, particularly the ones who filed for pensions.
Okay.
And it would be a very good thing for those looking into their family trees to look into that as a potential place for records on their ancestors.
Now, the reason I'm asking this is because we now know that the federal government, although this isn't a law enforcement agency, but this crime against humanity, this mass murder of these plantation workers, of these black people, Grover Cleveland was the president at the time. I mean, how did the federal government respond? It appears they didn't respond at all.
There was absolutely no response. And labor leaders and black ministers in New Orleans, after this happened, there was no voice for people in Thibodeau. The voice had been shot out of them. But there were community leaders in New Orleans who begged Congress to do something about this, to investigate. No investigation ever ensued. And if there was, we certainly would know about it after this research.
Yeah, and I can. And you're talking about Congress, the federal government. You're not talking about the state or legislative federal.
Oh, the state had no investigation at all.
I would figure
the
that.
The state had no interest in this. In fact, we're in the process of talking with some members of the Louisiana State Legislature now and the Louisiana Legislative Black Caucus at the state level to try to get official recognition of this event. And the state did nothing. The federal government did absolutely nothing. And I might add, one of the people tied it in very directly to events surrounding the massacre, including presence during the shooting of one man in particular, became a member of Congress 2 years later. there are buildings named after that man here.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. Now, that brings me to one other thing, and that's taking it back to after the Emmanuel 9 massacre that occurred in Charleston. In the preface of your book, you mentioned that the city council had moved to remove the Confederate statues and the symbolism and what have you. The response of North Carolina was to pass legislation to prevent even local counties and city councils from coming to a similar decision. And this is, of course, after the Confederate battle flag was removed from one of the Confederate battle flags were removed from the South Carolina State House. So that was the response of my state, North Carolina. Oh, we're going to protect these monuments. I call them monuments to white supremacy. And so I assume that in Thibodeau, there is perhaps they're thinking about it. If not, they should. Is there any kind of monument to the victims of this massacre?
I am in the process right now with a group of clergymen and some other community leaders, including Burnell Talbert from the Lafourche Parish NAACP. We have received a commitment from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette for an exploration to be done, number one, of the place where we believe the mass grave is, to determine if indeed that is the place, if indeed it exists. If that is the case, clergymen, family members, all these people we've gathered together have already agreed that they are supportive of having what remains there are removed, DNA tested, and so on, and any artifacts preserved, for those bodies to be reinterred in sacred ground with the help of the community. And that would be a very likely place. That is the place where they may be resting now for a monument. Also, the NAACP has been involved with us in terms of seeing about, at the very least, a marker. But there is an 1887 Louisiana Memorial Committee. The nonprofit papers during the process of being drawn up, and its purpose, on the basis of this research, is going to be to see that these people are not forgotten.
Well, I certainly thank you for your role in telling this story. After reading the book, what is it that you hope that the reader will come away with? And again, if you would like to get an autographed copy of the Thibodeau Massacre, Racial Violence in the 1887 Sugarcane Labor Strike, you can go to his website, johndesantis.org. That is John, DESANTIS, johndesantis.org. We have linked it up for you on our broadcast page, and of course that's where the archive will be, so if you're listening to it later you can get there as well from that link. What do you hope the readers will come away from this book? And I'm gonna be honest with you, I haven't finished it, but what I have, it's depressing, but it I have to read it though, but it's very, very depressing. It's not a story that's you're going to walk away smiling or anything like that. But what do you hope people take away from this? Is there any lessons to be learned, especially with the current political climate and everything we saw out there on the political campaign trail and the protest and the different reports associated with the racial climate that's out there now? So I know I asked more than one question. If you could sort those out and take a stab at it, please.
Absolutely, and it's a very good question, Scotty. First and foremost, one of the things that, and there are different things that black readers and white readers will take away from this, and depending on how close they are geographically or how far. And one of them is this. It becomes clear to anyone giving a thorough reading to this book that what caused these deaths was fear-mongering and rumor. We've had a whole bunch bunch of all of that going on. The crucifixion of the Black Lives Matter movement by some people in mainstream, the labeling, the branding, the words that have been spoken not in truth. We need to recognize, all of us, that fear and untruths are what end up leading to deaths. And we saw this in other countries. We've seen it many times right here, and we've certainly seen it. We've certainly seen it in this situation that occurred in Thibodaux. That's one of the things that I hope they will carry away. Another thing that I hope this book can do, and I tried to write it in as balanced a way as I could, if there can be such a thing as balance with a situation like this. But one of the things I am hoping is that this book can serve as an opportunity for communities where atrocities like this have occurred, maybe to reach out across color lines, mourn our dead together as one community. You know, if we do this thing that we want to do with the victims from this atrocity, it is not my hope that there will be just black people there. I want to see white people from this community mourning along with them. And I believe in my heart, as someone who has, unfortunately, and I can't tell you why, but I've ended up in the middle of a lot of situations in my career that have involved racial animus in Mississippi, in New York, and certainly here. And it's my hope that maybe if everyone's reading the same book, that maybe we can start that dialogue in places where it has not begun yet.
Well, I'm definitely, this is a conversation starter. Yeah, most definitely. But I want to thank you for the very valuable service that you have provided by documenting this event, by even connecting families to their own personal history. So I just hope that people will get a copy of this book and participate in the events that are going on there in Thibodaux and surrounding areas. I just can't thank you enough, and I hope to have you back on. Now, I do have an unrelated question, Mr. DeSantis. You know what this book reminds me of? You know what this incident reminds me of? The reports that I was reading out of The Nation, and I can't remember the independent journalist's name. It may be Jeremy Scahill. When he went down to Algiers Point and was documenting the racial violence in Algiers Point as white residents were shooting at and killing people trying to escape the floods down there in New Orleans.
Oh, yes. Yes. Do we have a quick second for me to
yes.
add something about that?
Yes, sir.
I had a conversation with someone in Wilmington, North Carolina, actually, a number of years ago. It was after Katrina, and I was in Wilmington, but I had come to New Orleans to do special coverage of Katrina for the New York Times. And there was a white fellow that I was talking with, and someone I knew from Louisiana, actually, and he was relating his Katrina experience, and he said that yes, the water was rising and we were trying to get out of there, and then we saw all these black people running towards our car, and we had to get out of there because we were really scared. And I looked at him and I said, wait a minute, brother, don't you think maybe they were running from the same thing you were, which was the water? They didn't want to hurt you. They were running from the water. You were running from the water. And this is what people must get over, and it goes back to that question about fear and about fear mongering and about fearing each other. And hopefully, I'm starting to get a little old now, but hopefully I'll maybe live to see it get a bit better.
Well, we hope you will be alive when it gets better. I don't know what better means, because I think the world's pretty messed up right now, but I'm not a pessimist. I do have hope, and I hope that we do not have the same climate, the same things going on when my grandsons become of age, which, you know, will be shortly. They grow up so fast. So I have that same hope with you. But again, thank you again for your service in documenting this very, very important story. And I just hope that people will pick it up and be informed about not only the history that is related here, but how history often can and does repeat itself, so that we can prevent other incidents like this occurring. Thank you again, Mr. DeSantis, and you have a great day, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Reed.
Okay, we're going to take a music break, and after we come back from the break, I just want to get into some of the news of the day. Of course, you can also, if you have any questions or any comments for me, you can do so. Any commentary on what you heard during the first hour of BTR News with our special guest, Mr. John DeSantis. Give us a call at 866-510-9025. You will hit ** to unmute yourself. Just watch your background noise, please. But there is a very important story. It's important to me. It happened here in my county. There was a press conference. You had a U.S. congressman in attendance, Patrick McHenry. He is the congressman over this district, the board member out of this area for USA Inc. Also, you had Senator Tom Tillis. I believe he out of Charlotte area. He used to be a Charlotte, a state representative out of Charlotte before he got promoted to the Senate. But they were at this press conference and is announcing a program here where I live, drug diversion program. Now, again, why do I think that everyone needs to hear this? Well, because Senator Tom Tillis is saying that this is similar to some stuff they're going to be looking to fund, and talking about the criminal justice reform. And let me give a quick personal story about him before I go to break. But I remember reporting not that long ago, the DEA was about to put yet another natural plant that indigenous people have been using for thousands of years in a medicinal or recreational purpose. But I can't remember, I think it was called Khartoum or something like that. And it's a plant that grows in what country? Thailand, I believe, is where it grows. One of those countries over there. It naturally grows. And what they have found is that if you're trying to get off of heroin, if you're a heroin addict, that it will help you get off of heroin. The indigenous people over there, they use it as a painkiller. They drink it in some kind of brew where it also, you know, help them relax, but it mostly to deal with pain and things of that nature. But people have found that it will lessen the physical convulsions and stuff that people who are having these withdrawal symptoms and what have you, it will lessen that. So people have been importing this plant and using it to get off of heroin. So here comes the DEA saying that, oh, we're just going to arbitrarily outlaw this plant. We haven't done any kind of research. Oh, we heard this and that, a couple of stories, about 10 stories of people dying from using this. Never mind the fact that they had other drugs in their system and other causes that could have caused them to die. I mean, I haven't heard any reports of anybody ODing on this, just like cannabis. So anyway, I wrote to Tom Tillis about that, complaining about that and saying they are just arbitrarily throwing plants onto the scheduled list of drugs. People are using this to get off of hard drugs and what have you, and they are not following protocol. And he wrote me back. He wrote me back agreeing with my assessment. He even used the words draconian. and what have you to describe what the DEA did. And they reversed course. So, yeah, he had wrote me and told me that him and a couple of other senators had sent a letter to the DEA. So, yeah, I'm going to play that on the other side, talk about the drug war. You know, I was talking about it yesterday. So we can talk about the things that may be coming down the pipe in terms of criminal justice reform, although I'm not a reformist, I'm an abolitionist. I want to abolish the drug war. Nobody should be going to prison, being put into modern-day slavery over especially plants. Give me a break. Stop trying to dominate people and make them bend to your will. They're not harming you. Stop harming them. So you're listening to Black Talk Radio News. My name is Scotty Reed, broadcasting from behind the enemy lines of USA Inc.
Make Black Talk Radio your choice for digital black radio. New black media for the new millennium.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States and Mr. Christian Champagne.
I'm a Dubai ranking, I'm a Baker Tilling in DC. Cause I know Obama, y'all will tell my mama, I'm moving east to DC. I'm a Dubai ranking, I'm a Baker Tilling in DC. Cause I know Obama, I'm gonna make some money, mama, you gon' be proud of me.
You have to ask yourself, what is a state? Then you have to take an inventory of every single thing that goes into the making of a state. Let's start with a safety pin. You hold your child's diaper together. If you've got to buy a safety pin from your former colonial master, then you're a liar when you say you built a state. You're a sham. If you're going to build a state, then everything that's needed to maintain that state should be ready. You should have trained people to handle your harbor. Your people, not ours.
I'm a Dubai ranking frontman. I'm a Baker Tilling in D.C. Cause I know Obama, y'all will tell my mama I'm moving east to D.C. I'm a Dubai ranking frontman. I'ma make a killing in D.C. Cause I know Obama, I'm gonna make some money. Mama, you gon' be proud of me.
When you don't have all those things functioning for you in your hands, you're an imitation of a state. We have done the wrong thing with our children. Let them have that choice about what to study. You study what we need. A few years ago, when I was in East Germany, a German teacher told me, he said that I know right now how many refrigeration workers I'm going to need 20 years from now. So I turned to the school and said, turn them out.
I'ma make a killing in D.C. Cause I know Obama, y'all will tell my mama I'm moving east to D.C. I'ma do my run, get run free. I'ma make a killing in D.C. Cause I know Obama, I'ma make some money. Mama, you gon' be proud of me. I'ma do my run, get run free. I'ma make a killing in D.C. Cause I know Obama, y'all will tell my mama I'm moving east to D.C. I'ma do my run, get run free. I'ma make a killing in D.C. Cause I know Obama, I'ma make some money. Mama, you gon' be proud of me.
I'm an avid baseball player and a huge fan of Chicago White Sox.
That's right.
My neighborhood is tough. It isn't always safe. Just recently, I was robbed while walking home from school. But those challenges have not stopped me from wanting to have a better, safer place.
We're going to have to be bold enough to line our children up and say that in order to maintain our state, we need so many harbor experts.
We need so many mining engineers, so many people who know metals, so many oceanographers, so many people to handle the fisheries. Now, what you want to study? You said music. Is it Bill State? Will it Bill State? First things first. You know people have to be healthy. You know people have to be educated. You know people have to be fed. So you train people to do these basic things. And once these things are taken care of, and you've got extra, I don't mean 10 harbor managers, you got 10, you got 20 in training. You've got all the people in place needed to hold the state together without you turning outside. Okay, Johnny, you want to play the violin, it's all right. But get the state straightened out first.
Because it's evil. Well, white supremacy is a system. And what does white supremacy really mean? It just doesn't mean somebody being in charge. No one should care about who's in charge of anything. If the person is not mistreating people, white supremacy is about mistreating people based on what? Based on the color in the skin of those people who are being mistreated. That's all it is. It's a form of mistreatment. There are all kinds of mistreatment in the world, but that's the greatest form of mistreatment. That's why it's supreme. Because it's the greatest form of mistreatment. If you want to look for mistreatment of the people anywhere on the planet, most people are being mistreated based on color. That's what it is. You know, if it's just two people on Earth, I mean, one person might mistreat another person just because the person is jealous or envious or something. Yeah. There's all kinds of ways to mistreat people for all kinds of reasons. But this business about racism is about mistreating people based on color.
This is the 21st century, and we need to redefine revolution. This planet needs a people's revolution, a humanist revolution. Revolution is not about bloodshed or about going to the mountains and fighting. We'll fight if we are forced to. But the fundamental goal of revolution must be peace. We need a revolution of the mind. We need a revolution of the heart. We need a revolution of the spirit. The power of people is stronger than any weapon. A people's revolution can't be stopped. We need to be weapons of mass construction. Weapons of mass love. System. We need to change ourselves. We have got to make this world user-friendly. User-friendly. Are you ready to sacrifice to end world hunger? To sacrifice to end colonialism? To end neocolonialism? Means the end of exploitation. Revolution means respecting people from other cultures. Revolution is creative. Revolution means treating your mate as a friend and an equal. Revolution is sexy. Revolution is love.
You are tuned in to the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts and live program scheduling, visit us on the web at blacktalkradionetwork.com. To Black Talk Radio News. Again, this is Scotty Reed, and I'm broadcasting from behind the enemy lines of USA Inc. If you have a question or comment that you would like to share on air, give us a call at 866-510-9025. That's 866-510-9025. Coming up at 6 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time on the network will be Tando Radio Show, hosted by Brother Dave. And then at 9 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time will be the Code Breakers. We got D and Paradox and Mr. T also hosting that program. So we do have more live programming for you on the network today, and we hope that you will keep it locked in. And also share the station with your friends. All right, so I said before the break, oh, and by the way, you do have to hit ** to unmute yourself. I said before the break that I wanted to play this press conference that happened here in the county that I live in. It was called the Gaston County Drug Diversion and Treatment Program. Now, let me give you some background, because some people have commented on this video, and they were saying, oh, all of a sudden they want to be the kind, gentle law enforcement and not just throw people into slavery. I actually want to try to get them some help and send them to treatment as opposed into slavery and what have you. This county, like I've mentioned many times before, 80% white, might be more than that, 80% white. It has been described by law enforcement in the state as being the capital, the meth capital of North Carolina. We have a lot of wooded areas. It's a rural area that I live in, and so we have a lot of wooded areas. I don't know if anybody has any steels in the woods. That's where, you know, you're making liquor and white lightning and all that kind of stuff. But I'm sure they got meth labs up in these woods, too. So they describe this. There's a lot of people that is hooked on drugs in this county, a lot of white people hooked on drugs. That's part of the underground economy here, being that the cotton mills have closed. There's only one that I know of that's still open in this area in Mount Holly. The truck manufacturing plant, while it's still open, they laid off a whole bunch of shifts and what have you. So Gaston County is no different than many other places across this country where people are unemployed or underemployed, and so many of them will turn to drugs and selling drugs and what have you. So I don't want to say this is the sole reason that they being kinder and gentler with people who may have addiction problems and whatnot. I hope that it ain't cause of the skin color of these people, but it probably is. But guess what, though? If everybody else benefit from this kinder, gentler policy, then so be it. But again, I'm an abolitionist, so don't think I'm co-signing on to any kind of reform. I'm an abolitionist. Nobody should be going to jail, going to prison for using drugs. It's illogical. It is a waste of our property taxes, any kind of income taxes we paying, to lock people up for that. If they want to smoke meth, let them smoke meth, long as they not breaking in people's houses to pay for their meth habits. But if they are, then we put them in prison for breaking and entering. But I think it's a huge waste of resources to be putting people into slavery over drugs when that money could be used for treatment, public education. So let me play this clip again. This happened, let me see when this video was posted. This happened
yesterday here in Gaston County.
Called me and asked about a relative who was addicted to opioids, prescription opioids, and how it impacted their family and how it was destructing and destroying their family, and that they tried every program available and just couldn't get anything to be successful and to stick. And it was at that time that I started thinking and meeting with some of our partners to talk about how we could take a different approach to solving the opioid and heroin abuse program.
I'm going to stop it right there. I'm not sure if that is the Gastonia police. That looked like the Gaston police logo. But this is a white man in uniform. And he's talking about white people hooked on drugs. So just so you know.
Problem here in Gaston County. We had many roundtables in order to try and get the perfect approach or the best approach in this process. And we felt like the holistic approach was the best option. And when I say holistic, I mean taking an individual from being addicted to drugs to revamping their lives to where they are successful, to owning homes, to having jobs at the end of the program. And so in a program of that size, it takes a lot of community partners, and many of them, even more than are listed on this panel behind me, have sat at the table and been willing to partner with us to solve this issue. Opioid addiction is a disease that's unforgiving, and as a chief, and as Chief Helton is in the room as well, we knew that we couldn't arrest our way out of this. And the drug diversion and treatment center is the result of this brainstorming for an approach that does more than treat addiction. The DDAT's mission is to emphasize rehabilitation over incarceration. The effort.
Now, I want to stop it again right there because, see, we talking about, remember who we talking about. We talking about predominantly white people. We're talking about predominantly black people. We'll be talking about locking them up and throwing them into slavery. So now they're saying that we can't enslave our way out of this problem or whatever.
It's between law enforcement, drug treatment providers, health providers, social service providers, and many community resources to provide this holistic residential treatment program. Again, the goal is to reduce the health, societal, and economic cost associated with illegal opioid abuse as well as prescription opioid abuse, while helping those affected by the disease rebuild their lives. At this time, I want to introduce U.S. Senator Tom Tillis, who's here with us today, to come up and speak. He is the sponsor of the Comprehensive Addiction and Recovery Act. And again, our U.S. Senator, Tom Tillis.
Thank you, Chief. I also want to say hello to a former colleague, Pearl Burris Floyd, sitting up here. It's wonderful to see you here and continuing to be involved in the community. And I appreciate Congressman McHenry's office being represented here as well. This is a very important part of a fabric that we've got to create in North Carolina across the country to deal with the increasing threat of opioid abuse. In North Carolina, more people died from opioid overdoses, either heroin or prescription opiates, than died in traffic accidents in 2014. Some 1,400 people. People need help. Communities need help, and we need to solve the problem on a holistic basis. I want to compliment the partners in Gaston County for their leadership here. This is exactly the kind of thing that we envision when we supported the Comprehensive Addiction and Recovery Act. I was mentioning as I came in here that we're going to go back into session, and we'll be fighting hard to get the full funding that we want so that this can be another layer, CARA can be another layer on what you're doing on the ground, which is critically important. And then we can start fighting for funding through CARA that I think this program is likely to be able to receive a grant for. But we've got to work on an integrated basis, public-private partnerships, working with the state, working with the federal government to begin to solve this problem. And it's critically important that we make sure that our men and women, first responders, police officers, and first responders have the tools that they need to potentially save a life. That's why Narcan or Naloxone is a very important part of the resources that we're trying to get down to the local communities in the event that somebody has overdosed, to potentially literally turn their life around with the administration of this drug. So for as long as I'm in the U.S. Senate, I'm going to do everything I can to help you all. And by the way, I should back up and say there are other things that we need to do. Sentencing reform at the federal level is taking a look at how we get people who went into prison but may have done so because of a mental health or a drug addiction. How do we find a way to carve them out from a population that's very different and try to do everything we can, like we did in North Carolina with the Justice Reinvestment Act just a few years ago? This is turning around the way that we look at rehabilitating people who go into the system and recognizing mental health and drug-driven crimes are, in most cases, different from some of the other people that absolutely need to be locked up. We need to find as many as possible that we can rehabilitate, make productive members of the community, and this is a step in that direction. As long as I'm a U.S. Senator, I'm going to keep on working to make sure you can get the funding that you need to expand this program, create more programs like this across the 100 counties in North Carolina, but also look for other programs that get good people out of prison and put them in productive lives. We can do it together. I appreciate you all's leadership and support. Thank you.
So that was Senator Tom Tillis. He hasn't been there that long. I think he got elected. When would that be? Would that be 2012 or 2014? I'm not sure. But, yeah, that's Tom Tillis. And I'm just putting out there that, hey, as long as he's a U.S. senator, I'm going to keep writing him and keep pressing him and Patrick McHenry and anybody else, any of these other officials. When I find out about these kind of meetings, and I had no forewarning of this, and I wouldn't have been able to go because of the work I have to do here with the station. But I have been to others, and I have spread the abolitionist message in terms of the drug war being illogical, and we shouldn't be locking up people over drugs. It's just a failed policy. It was put in place to put people into slavery, and I am glad to hear that type of language come from his mouth. Maybe he'll be receptive to the abolitionist message in terms of the drug war. But again, I am under no illusion. These are racist suspects. I can't say if Tom Tillis is a racist for sure. I don't know, but I suspect him. But I will work with anybody if they can get me what I want. And what do I want? I want freedom. I want freedom for the million plus slaves on the plantation in America today by any means necessary. All right. So I thought that was very, very important information about what might be coming down the pipe in terms of criminal justice reform, in terms of how America is dealing with this drug epidemic problem. Again, it's mostly affecting white people, and they've taken a totally different approach than what they took in the 90s and what have you during the Clinton administration. But here is something else I picked up from listening to this. Over the past couple of programs, primarily last week, and this, I guess, has scarred me. I don't know why I keep bringing it up or why it's at the forefront of my memory right now. But when that black woman, PhD, up there in Virginia, Richmond, Virginia, PhD in business and what have you, teaching at a HBCU. And when they were discussing on a radio program that she was on, when they were discussing what might become what a Trump administration policies, what have you, was going to look like. And of course, you know, he's talked about the 2 to 3 million. I think they played that clip, the 2 to 3 million. Undocumented immigrants that they're either going to put into slavery or they're going to deport. So she said, on hearing that news, she said, come on, black people, let's get our money together and buy jail so we can make some money off these Mexicans. Very, very disgusting thought to come, especially from a black person. I don't know if she's a descendant of enslaved Africans or not. Not that that matters here or there, but if she is, how could you let such words pass through your lips like that? Talking about profiting off of slavery on another group. Now, that's what she got from hearing that clip of Donald Trump talking about lock them up. What I got from this clip, from a business perspective, not that I'm looking to go into this business, but hearing this clip, it seems to me then, why don't y'all get y'all money together and start a treatment center and make some money helping people instead of make some money enslaving people? How about that? Because that's what I'm hearing. Is he was talking about, hey, y'all might be able to get some grants for this drug treatment program and what have you, helping people stay out of slavery and treat their addiction. That seems to be the direction that they're going, since all these white people are ODing all across America on this heroin that their government is allowing to be flooding the streets that's coming straight from Afghanistan. So I see a business opportunity there. Well, perhaps you don't have, you know, it in you to become an entrepreneur in this industry. Well, maybe you just like, you know, and I'm not saying anything bad about it, because we all need, businesses need workers to operate. There's no shame in being a worker. No shame. Honest living, no shame in that. So, but they're going to need what? Drug treatment counselors. And I don't even think you have to go to school for a number of years to get a degree or a diploma or a certification. I think that would probably be certification in drug counseling. Since they're talking about coming down the pipe, fighting for funding for these drug diversion programs, I can see a need for drug treatment counselors in drug treatment centers. So there's an opportunity. Now that, you know, making money should always be the reason that we do things, but if you're that type of person, instead of you investing in private prison slavery, how about investing in some drug treatment and counseling centers? How about that? All right, so let me check the board. Sometimes I talk and I missed the board. Again, if you have any questions or comments that you would like to share, 866-510-9025 is how you can do that. Our other number is 704-802-5056. So that's what I think about what's going on. And again, like I said, I know what's going on in this county. Like I had mentioned before, that jail is full of white people, on drugs or dealing drugs and what have you. All right, let me pull up a couple of news items of the day. I'm going to visit btrcommunity.com. btrcommunity.com is a social media platform that has been set up by the Black Talk Media Project, the organization that has brought you Black Talk Radio Network. It is a subscriber-based community. That is how we look to fund our operations. Another way we can fund our operations by charging a $24 a year, not a month, a year subscription fee. You pay more than that probably for the daily paper or your subscription to the New York Times and what have you. And as Dave has often said, we are not looking to exploit your information. There is no data mining going on, because guess what? Ain't no ads. So we can't use the excuse, oh, we need to be all up in your private messages and monitoring everything that you type out with these software programs, so that we can decide what kind of ads we should show you. Yeah, whatever. None of that's going on at btrcommunity.com. Let me get logged in here. I'm going to go to the video section as I post it. A couple of news items. Some of the stuff that's going on today. A couple of interesting things that I can share as we have a little bit of time. Before we get ready to close it out, again, coming up at 6 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time will be Tando Radio Show. And at 9 o'clock tonight, 9 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time, will be the Code Breakers. All right, let me pull up this video. Chris Hedges says that Trump will crush dissent with even greater violence and savagery. And my comments to that was, you mean even more savage than prior administrations and what have you? We'll see. So let's hear what they're talking about, see what they're talking about.
It's the Real News Network. I'm Sharmini Pires coming to you from Baltimore. One of the major concerns that many have about President Trump is that given his authoritarian tendencies, he would be prone to use powers of the presidency to a far greater extent than, say, President Obama did. One of these powers that most people are not aware of is embodied in the National Defense Authorization Act, the NDAA. Normally, this act is simply to provide funding for the U.S. military. However, in 2012, the NDAA included several controversial provisions, such as giving the president authority to indefinitely detain civilians. Shortly after the NDAA was passed, Chris Hedges, with several other people, challenged the Obama administration in court. Now we have the possibility of a Newt Gingrich, who might be presiding over such matters and who will be advising a President Trump. He's uttering the possibility of reestablishing a committee on un-American activities. Let's have a look at his response in a recent interview he did.
So let me go a step further.
Yeah.
Because remember, San Bernardino, Fort Hood, and Orlando involve American citizens. We're going to ultimately declare war on Islamic supremacists, and we're going to say, if you pledge allegiance to ISIS, you are a traitor, and you have lost your citizenship. And we're going to take much tougher positions. In the late 1930s, President Franklin Roosevelt...
Okay, I want to stop it there, because that is the racist... Not a racist suspect, but that's the racist. He might even have white supremacist status. Man, I just forgot his his name. Newt Gingrich, the former partner in crime to Bill Clinton when they passed that legislation to lock up everybody, provided $1 billion that they took from the TANF program, social services and stuff like that, and transferred it to a private prison fund that they was going to use to hire these private prison contractors and what have you. But one of the key things he said right there, if you pledge allegiance to ISIS, blah, 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 we're going to strip you of your citizenship. That's very important right there. That's very important. So he's talking about American citizens stripping them of their citizenship on the allegation. Because remember, they don't have to prove anything. All they have to do is label you like they've done label people in the past. Enemy combatants, strip them of their rights, take them into military custody, torture them and what have you. There's a guy's face that's coming to my mind right now. He was a U.S. citizen, and they treated him in similar fashion. That means they will torture you. You don't have any constitutional protections whatsoever. In fact, we're going to treat you like one of these slaves that we've branded. Again, don't have to prove nothing. Don't have to prove. Or we'll use executive authority to label you. And then also, I'm just reminded of the interview we just got through with Mr. John DeSantis about the Thibodeau massacre. All of this fear and rhetoric.
Roosevelt was faced with Nazi penetration in the United States. We originally created the House Un-American Activities Committee to go after Nazis. We passed several laws in 1938 and 1939 to go after Nazis. And we made it illegal to help the Nazis. We're going to presently have to go take the similar steps here.
Now joining us to talk about all of this is Chris Hedges. Chris is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, a columnist at Truthdig and Alternate. He was the Middle East Bureau Chief for the New York Times and has reported extensively from the Middle East. Chris, good to have you back.
Thank you.
Chris, what do you make of that clip we just ran of Newt Gingrich and what this holds for us in terms of the NDAA's implementation inside the country?
Right. Well, Section 1021 of the National Defense Authorization Act, which was signed into law by Obama at midnight 2011, essentially permits the government to carry out acts of extraordinary rendition on the streets of American cities against U.S. citizens who, quote-unquote, substantially support, whatever that means, Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, or something called Associated Forces, another nebulous term, to strip them of due process and hold them indefinitely in military detention centers, including in our black sites overseas, such as Guantanamo or anywhere else. That section has been renewed every year. I went to the Southern District Court of New York and sued Obama. We won. The Obama administration appealed the decision. We went to the Second Circuit. The Second Circuit denied my standing, which essentially means they denied my right to bring the case. We filed a petition to the Supreme Court to ask them to hear it, and they also denied my right to bring the case, essentially enshrining this in law. During that two-year legal battle, the lawyers, Carl Mayer and Bruce Afron, approached the Democratic leadership around Pelosi and said, because they do have to renew it every year, all you have to do is insert into that language that this does not apply to U.S. citizens, and we will drop the lawsuit. Of course, they didn't do that because it does apply to U.S. citizens. It was written for the containment of U.S. citizens in a moment of unrest. It overturned the 1878 Posse Comitatus Act, which prohibits the military from acting as a domestic police force. Why? Well, because climate change, economic dislocation, the ruling elites understand that the possibility of widespread unrest is possible, and they want to use the military as a mechanism by which that unrest is crushed. Obama, when he signed it into law, said that he wouldn't use it. That gave it no legal, it didn't mean anything legally. He could use it if he wanted to. He just, in a signing statement, said he wouldn't. We have seen most all of our constitutional rights, including our right to privacy, overturned by judicial fiat. Unlimited corporate campaign contributions through Citizens United becomes the right to petition the government, a form of free speech. This is upending the traditional notions of constitutional rights, habeas corpus, due process, of course, as we saw with Section 1021 of the NDAA has been removed. On and on and on again, coupled with the most sophisticated security and surveillance apparatus in human history. All of this is in the hands of figures like Donald Trump, Rudy Giuliani, John Bolton, and others. And given what I expect is going to be the seismic reaction to the ineptitude and the inability on the part of a Trump presidency to respond to the most pressing issues facing the majority of Americans, they will use all of the tools at their disposal. And they were handed these tools by the Republican and the Democratic Party. And this is something that all of us, Ralph Nader perhaps being at the forefront, who have been fighting against the legal erosion of our civil liberties, have been warning about and fearing for some time, and now it's here.
All right, Chris, so the courts are one mechanism of challenging a Trump. But there are many people out there who believe that really only way to challenge this is on the streets, and we saw much of that taking place last night. And since you are the author of a very famous book called Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt, what should activists and those who are resisting a Trump presidency do about these kinds of situations here?
Well, yeah, the only mechanism we have left is civil disobedience, but let's not pretend democracy died on November 8th. We haven't been living in a functioning democracy for some time. There are no institutions left that can authentically be considered democratic. They're all essentially controlled by corporate power, the mass media, academia, the political establishment. Civil disobedience, just as we saw before, But the difference is that the state, I think, under a Trump administration, will respond even more violently and even more savagely. And you, I think, got a glimpse of that in the Newt Gingrich clip. Anybody who dissents will be considered a traitor, maybe a terrorist. They will certainly be demonized in a subservient corporate media by a Trump administration. So I think, yes, that is the response. Unfortunately, that was the response. And it's a response we should have stepped outside the mainstream a long time ago, so we didn't end up now in this in the grip of an administration that is, going to run roughshod over all constitutional legal restraints.
All right, so that's Chris Hedges. I really enjoy this man's writing. He knows that slavery was never abolished. He's written about the 13th Amendment and prison slavery. So as they said, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, and he expects Donald Trump administration to be more vicious, to be more violent than any of the previous administrations. And so, again, I tell people, man, if you want to know what's going on, or if you want to get a heads up of what may be coming down the pipe, you have to pay attention to politics. I ain't saying get all caught up in the emotions. I was talking to my aunt earlier this morning, who's visiting down here with us from Detroit, and she was talking about her and my cousin, one of my cousins who's real close. They went to high school together, and they're real close, and they'd be on the phone, and she was saying how he'd be talking about CNN, and he was a Hillary supporter, and talking about what he was seeing on CNN and yelling at the TV and stuff like that. And she was just saying, wow, man, you need to really calm down and not let this stuff get you upset like that. Now, again, we are talking about very serious issues here, and so you should be paying attention. But again, if you're paying attention, if you're, all your sources are CNN, the corporate media that Chris Hedges was talking about, chances are you're going to be very misinformed. Now, if you are trained and you've been doing it for a while, you can try to, you can glean information from them without being affected by the propaganda. But that takes practice. That takes practice, because we've been trained to think that these corporations and these people with names that, you know, they are the authoritative source on everything, and they would never lie to us and be honest. But like Ron Paul pointed out the other day when they was talking about fake, doing something about fake news on Facebook, and Ron Paul pointed out all, he even pointed out reporters as well as organizations who have been pushing fake news out to the people for a very long time to get justification and public opinion on their side so they can go do what they always do, and that's spread violence around the world as they look to steal other resources on behalf of their fellow corporations. So, anyway, I expect, again, it to get pretty difficult for people moving behind these enemy lines, especially if you are looking a certain kind of way, like you may not be born here. I mean, really, that could be my daughter, to be honest with y'all. Like my aunt was saying, my daughter, my oldest daughter, she could pass as a Hispanic. Again, you know, I'm black, I'm a light-skinned black person, her mother's Hawaiian, Chinese, and Samoan. She could pass for a Mexican till she start talking, then you know she black. But she could pass for a Mexican. But that's, people who look like that, it's finna get bad for y'all. They're gonna be racially profiling you. It's finna get bad. Again, all the people that he's talked about or have been mentioned appointing to his administration, they all believe in stop and frisk. But now you're starting to see the tools, the executive power that this man will assume once CEO Obama is out the door. That drone program, nobody's safe on the planet, man. Nobody. But I'm going to tell you, they don't scare me. as Chris Hedges said, they will be going after people for dissent and all of that. Well, you know what? I just don't live in fear of nothing. What will happen will happen. I'm going to express myself with my free will to do so. I will not be silenced because I'm worried about what may happen to me personally. That ship being sailed. If I was worried about that, I would have never got started. Or this would be Coon Network Central, you know. So anyway, pay attention to what's going on. Some things are about to get worse than they are for certain types of people in this country. And it's all fear-based, fear-driven, manufactured fear. These people create the conditions and then they come and act like they got the solution, and that's often not the case. It's cover to do something more sinister. That's my program for today. Coming up here in just a bit will be Tando Radio Show. Make sure y'all keep it locked for that. Recognize the fact that you live behind the enemy lines of USA Inc., where slavery is the supreme law of the land. You don't get to have the world's largest prison population if slavery wasn't the law of the land. It is not the home of the free and the brave. No, it's the home of the enslaved. So you have to take precautions, but most of all, you have to fight. You cannot just stand there and take it. You have to fight this by any means necessary. However way the Creator directs you to get involved in the fight. So with that said, y'all just be safe out there. I will be back on air tomorrow night as I'm part of New Abolitionist Radio, and we broadcast every Wednesday night at 8 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time. Oh yeah, that reminds me, Tanya Free and Friends talk show that comes on Wednesdays at 2 o'clock p.m. will not be on air tomorrow as they're taking the holiday break, but I will be on air at 8 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time tomorrow with my comrades, my abolitionist comrades, Max and Johanna on New Abolitionist Radio. Hope that y'all will join us for that. So y'all be safe out there. Peace and blessings to all.